Shalom, everybody, and welcome to the Ishai Fleischer Show, broadcasting live from Judea to the world. You're part of it wherever you are. Shalom, and welcome to Malka Fleischer.
Hello.
All right, Malka, we got a great show today. We got Ben Bresky talking about history moment in Birchata Sultan, the Sultan's Pool in Jerusalem. We got Rabbi Shimshon Nadel talking about some very contentious topics about ultra-Orthodox Jews serving or not serving in the army.
Here we go.
That's right. We got Nadia Matar on a harsh type of issue. You'll hear about that in a minute.
Okay.
And we have Rav Mike Foyer with me talking about one of the most incredible Torah portions with the most amount of laws and Jewish. This is Moses's. The book of Deuteronomy has Moses's long speech, and this is one of the most, is the most densely packed Torah portion with laws.
Wow.
For the Jewish people and for the world.
Fun, so, for all the lawyers out there.
That's right. Actually, all of us that want to live a life that has a structure and a meaning and a purpose, a structure of holiness.
Right.
You like that, a structure of holiness?
Spirituality is very important.
Darn straight.
You got to have the soul connection to God, the soul connection to the people around you. But God also has boundaries and requirements from the Jewish people, and part of your service is not just about feeling good and connecting and all this stuff, but about doing the things that Hashem said to do the way he said to do them.
That's right. And you know, Malka, that reminds me to say to people, I sometimes don't think I make it clear, this show is intended for Jews, for lovers of God, for lovers of Israel, and for non-Jews around the world who want to be part of the story, who want to understand the story better, who want to connect to Torah.
I heard somebody wrote an article recently about how they would like it if they were not called non-Jews anymore. A pro-Israel person.
Right.
I wish that I had the name because I thought this was an interesting article. They were like, we don't want to be known as non-Jews.
That's right. It's annoying.
It's like
term.
Jews or non-Jews.
Right, right.
So, like, on the one hand, it's like, is Gentile a good word?
I think that
it doesn't often sound good to me, even though it is not derogatory.
No, not at all. I think a great one is the nations. The nations. The people of the nations. And by the way, I came up with a new stock phrase, which is donations from the nations. Okay.
Yeah. That's right. TM.
That's right. Continue to help build Israel by doing your part, by being part of the movement of donations from the nations. I like that a lot. I wasn't planning.
We're going to get
that
started.
That's right.
I was not ready to unveil it. Well, you unveiled it, and now we got to make the website.
Mini unveil.
Yes.
Donations from the nations. Speaking of the nation, our nation is under attack. Israel's under attack right now. The security folks and the politicians all admit that we're under a giant wave of attacks.
Mm-hmm.
And Yisrael Hayom yesterday came out with a montage of 35 people that have been murdered since the beginning of the year. And so we are in a jihad murder spree. And it's just so sickening to look at this picture.
It's a picture of all the faces of all the people that we've lost in just this year. And lo alain, of the year is not over. We just had taken from us a kindergarten teacher.
That's right.
Named Batsheva Nigri. She was from the Southern Hebron Hills.
She lived in Beit Chagai.
She lived in Beit Chagai near Hebron.
Right.
And she was with her neighbor getting a ride, going to go into Efrat to decorate her kindergarten, going to go with her daughter for a little bit of like pre-school year shopping, regular summertime action. And someone mowed down the car.
Not someone, a jihadist.
A jihadist.
A jihadist Arab-Palestinian activist
who,
terrorist killer.
Right. So she was killed on the spot. The driver, her neighbor, was taken to the hospital. And
my friend, Arya Gottlieb.
Arya Gottlieb, that he should have a refuah shlema. It's a horrific thing that happened to him, but he also experienced a miracle in that he wasn't hit in any of his major organs, which was a very big deal. Unfortunately, Batsheva's daughter was also in the car, but again, in a bittersweet miracle, she was untouched completely. Untouched physically, right? She was not shot.
22 bullets.
22 bullets went into the car.
Were found, and there's pictures of it on the side of the
car. It's so right. Nightmarish. Anyway, so I put a tweet up on X. I can't say it. I don't even care. I put a tweet up on Twitter.
You put an X up on X.
No,
it's fine.
I put a tweet on Twitter. That's my little act of protest here on this. So I put a tweet up on Twitter about her. And I was like, you know, she was murdered for like something, something occupation, something, something justice, something, something Palestine. Right. The tweet did a lot. It resonated with a lot of people. Some like 1300 people hit like on that tweet. But then there were the people who with whom it did not resonate. Are haters, right? And just the things that they say is like, it's so inhuman. It's so, and you would think to yourself that
like
other
what?
People,
wait, make it
like,
clear for people. Make it clear.
Okay, I don't have the comments in front of me, but things like, well, you know, she's like a fat Zio-Nazi, and it's good that she was like eradicated. She's an occupier. She's a thief. That's what happens to thieves and occupiers. What was she doing there? That's what a lot of people wrote, which I thought was like a very weird thing to write just independently. Like, what was she doing in occupied Palestine? Which is like, let's say that she was like stomping around with a frowny face and some military boots on. She's a kindergarten teacher. Like, what do you think she was doing? You think she was pulling grandmothers out of their orchards by their hair? Like, she was driving down the street. In what world is it okay to say that what Jews should not be walking around? Jews should not be walking around in that area. Like, what are Jews doing there? It's like saying that if an Arab is walking down the street in Efrat, you just shoot him. Like, what was he doing there? It's like he was walking. Like, what are we talking about here?
Yeah, I don't quite agree with you because what they're saying is just to be intellectually like clear about it. They are saying that we don't belong and that we have no rights in this land and this is Arab.
But you don't even have a basic right to not die.
Right, but that's what they're saying, and that's why we should hear them, and we should be like, okay, this narrative, we have to be clear about it. We have to fight the occupation narrative by making it as clear as possible that we are in our land forever. And that this is where we're going to be. And we have to make that clear. We can't talk about two-state solutions and all kinds of stuff. We got to be like, and we can't be supporting the PA. We got to be like, no, this is our land and we're going to be here forever. That's exactly what we're doing. And if we don't make that clear to them, then we add to their appetite. You know, Malka, I actually went to the street to meet the ambulance and the procession.
We don't have hearses in Israel.
Right. We don't use hearses.
Right. We use ambulances. Yes. Right.
And so this ambulance...
There are hearses. But anyway, in this case, use an ambulance.
And yeah. And it carried the body of Batsheva Nigri. And there I also got a chance to speak to one of the great activists and great people of our time, Nadia Matar. Here's my talk with her on the street, exactly as the procession of the murdered kindergarten teacher went by.
All right, folks. Just a few months ago, I was standing... in Efrat, waiting for the ambulance that was taking the wife of Leo D. and his two daughters to their funeral after they were murdered in the Samaria region. And since then, I think there was another time, and now yet again, I'm standing here on the street as a convoy of cars is driving by. It's nighttime. It's about 11 at night, 11:30. Today we are burying Batsheva Negri, who was a young mother and also a kindergarten teacher in Efrat. She was murdered today in a shooting. 22 bullets hit her the side of her car and took her life. Her daughter was in the back. Also, the guy who took them hitchhiking, tramping, as we say in Israel, is badly injured and fighting for his life. And we're standing here right now, myself with, I don't know, 200-300 people, 200 people maybe. And as we are standing here, there's a long line of cars coming up from South Hebron Hills, and they're taking a left here at the Gush Junction, going to the cemetery in Gush Etzion. And I'm standing here with the founder of Women in Green, and also the Sovereignty Movement co-founder, Nadia Matar. And Nadia, I saw your WhatsApp saying it's time to come down here and to show the support, and I'm with you. I was looking for you, and I wanted to catch a little bit of your voice on this thing that has become a disturbing regular phenomenon. I feel like it's become some kind of, you know, some kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? Some kind of regular rite that we are, some kind of rite of passage that we are now regularly doing, which is standing out here with flags and giving honor to the dead. So I wanted to ask you about that. Are we, like, is this an absurdity? Is this a beautiful thing that we're doing? Is this a pathetic thing that we're doing? I'm asking you as raw and honestly as I can.
Ishai, we're standing here with friends who have been doing this together with you and so many others for so many years. It's such a deja vu, and the feeling of helplessness is really big, and we have to start thinking what should be done. And I think it's we should connect it to what we're going to be mentioning in a couple of weeks, 30 years to the Oslo Accords. And it all started there. The crime of Oslo, first of all, the moral crime of basically agreeing to shake the hands of the mass murderer Yasser Arafat, give him an army. But more deeply than that, basically acknowledging as if, God forbid, this land belongs to him, or at least part of it. And that was, and now the time has come after 30 years of Oslo, when unfortunately Oslo is still alive and kicking, especially in the minds of the military leaders, i.e. accepting this group called the Palestinian Authority, which basically is a terrorist organization but has received the kashrus stempel because of the Oslo Agreement. Everything has to change now. We have to make a switch in our heads. After close to 2,000 Jews who were killed because of the Oslo Agreement, after the terrible tragedy of the Oslo mentality, saying that we should give our land to those Arabs, saying that we should give our security to the... We have to make a complete switch. And the cure, I'm sorry to sound maybe boring, but the cure will be sovereignty. Meaning the cure to the terrible Oslo agreements is to not just to build another yeshuv, and not just to have another few thousand Jews here. Of course we need to continue building. But the answer... is to be much bigger than just another settlement or another 10 settlements, communities. The answer has to be a game changer. And the game changer has to be to put an end to the Oslo Accords and to finally be victorious in the Six-Day War, which we didn't win yet. We didn't win the Six-Day War because we didn't apply sovereignty at the time. We had a partial victory, but now we need to be victorious. We need to... once and for all understand that the Palestinian Authority is no different than Hamas, and the Prime Minister today said that Iran is involved here also. It's all the same. It's all enemies who want to destroy us. We have to take responsibility. We have to apply sovereignty between the sea and the Jordan River, but not only apply sovereignty on paper, also implement it and be with a iron fist, take care of our right and bring back justice to the Jewish people in their homeland. Until that will be done, we got to meet.
We're going to have to keep standing like this.
We're going to have to meet here.
Right.
And that's what we're going to have to promote. That's what I have to say tonight on this terrible, terrible day.
So I just want to paint the scene. It's nighttime right now. We're at a pretty lit up junction. Behind us are a lot of soldiers and police. There was a group of Arabs over there, and not so far away from them was a group of settler youth type guys, whom I know partially from helping me build all kinds of different things. And the police came over and tried to break up any tension that would be there. And so there's a tense moment here. You're here with a lot of your activists. They're collecting the flags now because the caravan has passed. And you basically said, look, the Oslo mindset is still with us. It's still in the military's mind. But let's be real for a second, Nadia. Oslo as a reality on the ground is super real. It's not just a mentality. It's just in place.
It's alive and kicking.
They're
taking over our land. Every minute that we speak on the phone or on this radio show, they took over the Arab Palestinian Authority, funded by American and European anti-Israeli NGOs, are taking over Area C of our land. and are building a de facto...
Not to mention A and B.
A and B, of course. Right. Are building a de facto Palestinian state. And the answer to that, as I said, is not going to be just another community here or there, which of course has to be built.
But you're very practical. You've always been a very practical activist. We're standing right across from one of your great successes, which is the Oz and Gon Park area, which basically you took an area that was going to be taken over by the Palestinian Authority and gave it Jewish life, Israeli life. So you're a very practical thinker, an activist. Here we have now a super nationalist government. As we say in Hebrew, Yamin Male Male, that's the catchphrase, full right-wing government. And yet, the wheels of the bureaucracy do not turn easily, it seems. It seems like we just can't get out. And I also heard a report just the other day that Ron Dermer, I don't know if it's true or not, but I heard the report on the news that they said that Ron Dermer was talking with Blinken or whoever at Secretary of State about the future of the two-state solution again. And so how do we... Okay, like, I hear you, sovereignty, yes. But, like, what do we need to do? Do we need another right-wing government? Is that what the key is? Like, how do we shift the gears to actually get what is so sensical and obvious in place? Because the other side is exactly what you said. The Palestinians are building a Palestinian state in two phases. One is in physical buildings, and two is in the consciousness around the world. And that, I see it on Twitter, I see it on Instagram. They are succeeding in their consciousness building around the world to defame Israel and to build Palestine on our land.
We have to understand that, first of all, that our friends who are in the government now are people who really want to and believe, like us, in our right to this land. But then they became ministers and they realized that there is no magic here. You can't, within a few months, overturn 30 or 40 or 50 years of left-wing dictatorship, basically, and elite ruling. And we need to, on the one hand, strengthen them to continue to be right-wing and have patience, and also make sure that some people on the right, without mentioning names, who might be a little weaker and who might want to cave in, they have to understand that the only way they can stay in power is if they stick to the right-wing policies. So we have a very difficult job as right-wing activists now. Nobody wants this government to fall, because there's not going to be a better right-wing government. And we have to make sure to strengthen them, but also that they shouldn't feel that they can just do nothing. So we are in a very difficult position of, if we thought that after a right-wing government comes to power, we can go and rest, then we now found out that not. There's a very huge, important demonstration on September 7th, which is related to the judicial reform. And also, now we see that the left came out in masses to the streets. And we have to come out and strengthen this government to enforce what they were elected to do. And that will only happen if they feel us. You have to understand, our ministers are suffering daily harassments by the left. Mm-hmm. Every minister is being waited at home by Michigan anarchists who disturb their lives and who are driving them crazy. And we have to be there to counteract that. And so we have a lot of work. We have a lot of work. We have a work to strengthen them. We have to work to remind them what they have to do, and to give them also tachlis what should be done, which we believe in the sovereignty movement. Judith Katzover and myself and the whole group, that we should promote sovereignty, because that's a game changer. All the other things needs to be done. Of course, we need to enter all the Arab villages, take away their weapons. We need to continue building Jewish communities. But it's not going to work if there's no sovereignty. Sovereignty is the game changer. And if we have to start with something very tachless, first the Jordan Valley. The Jordan Valley first, because over 90% of the area there is Area C. It's completely empty. There's very few Arabs. The Jordan Valley first has a big consensus. That's what should be done tomorrow.
All right, Nadia, 22 bullets hit a car today.
No, it's not 22 bullets that hit a car today, and the same way that it is not that stones were thrown at somebody. Arab terrorists shot 22 bullets at a Jewish woman in order to murder her and the other people. And when they say stones are being thrown, Arab terrorists throw stones, and we have to finally deal with it.
All right, from Tzomet HaGush, I hope not to see you again here soon.
Likewise. difficult too.
That is intense stuff. I remember thinking to myself, that was a very,
very hard,
hard. And it was also very, like, there was such a surreal atmosphere out there in the streets that night, a few nights ago. And it was just so foggy and cold, and I don't know. There was something about it. It was haunting. It was a little bit of a haunting.
I mean,
maybe
you're
lucky.
You're lucky in a certain way that's how it was, because that's what's going on. That's the feeling that people are getting out here. And, you know, Ishai, I've seen, like, a lot of people, like, this is not the kind of thing I like to usually say, but I'm going to say it anyway, which is a lot of people who were very excited about this government are starting to get fed up. There are a lot of people who were excited about the most right-wing government in Israel's history, about some hardliners coming into power. And these people are starting to feel let down. This is a moment at which the government really needs to regroup, understand what it is that they were elected for, why at all they came into power, which really was primarily a security-based and Jewish identity-based platform.
That's right.
And they need to start serving the people again. I mean, as if they need a reminder that it should have been from day one, right? But but if they have lost the plot, maybe because of confusion from, you know, and distraction from the judicial reform things or whatever, they need to come back and realize that the whole reason that this government was formed was that the Jewish people could feel safe and free in the land of Israel.
That's right, Malka. You're absolutely right. And I think they want to. And I think that their claim is that they have not been given the tools to do so. But there are things in motion right now. Sadly, it takes these murders to, like, get people, like, to wake up. But there are things in motion now. And I really do pray that this government will not just deal with the terrorists who come at us, but starts to dismantle the terrorist infrastructure.
Right, shift
within.
The pattern here.
Shift the paradigm. Malka, first thing is to shift the pattern and the stuff that you read about Israel and the news out of Israel. I highly recommend people check out jns.org and jewishpress.com to really get a sense of what's going on in Israel in a healthy way. I'm going to say it here. Stay away from the Times of Israel. Stay away from that. That newspaper is full of poison and anti-Israelism. If you need to read that for balance, then go ahead. But I think that JNS.org and JewishPress.com will give you a much finer sense of really what's going on, and with a healthy mindset. Just to go the other direction altogether, which is if you're already consuming good media content, you also need to consume some great Jewish food like Prohibition Pickle. Prohibitionpickle.co.il makes your Shabbat so much fun. And I forgot to mention in the last few weeks that a great way to support your favorite show hosts on the Land of Israel Network or on any other platforms, you know, stuff out of Israel, is go to prohibitionpickle.co.il and just tell them I want to send a beautiful Shabbat package meal or whatever, some goodies out to my friends here in the Holy Land. It's a great way. And, of course, those friends, including yours truly and Malka, will be happy to bless you at our Shabbat table. So that's prohibitionpickle.co.il. And, of course, you want to get to the Land of Israel yourself. And we have so many ways to get people, to help people get here. One is Kaplan Custom Tours that help you prepare your trip, the details of your trip, and create a great itinerary and get you the best tour guides. So that's mokaplan@gmail.com. That's Kaplan Custom Tours, mokaplan@gmail.com. And our good friends at Kosher Cycle Tours that will, you know, just do that, give you a kosher tour on a bicycle, and you'll be able to ride in style in the land of Israel and around the world in a kosher and awesome way. So that's some of the great friends that that make the show possible. Malka, one of the things that makes Israel possible is the Israeli army. But does everybody need to go serve in the Israeli army? Like, some people don't serve, and that's, you know.
Well, some people say that it's, you know, why should my son be endangered and someone else's son not be endangered?
And other people say, I serve the country in a different way through learning Torah. And our own Rabbi Shimshon HaKohen Nedel, who loves to tackle the issues. That's one of his many great attributes. One of them is that he loves to tackle and unpack the very issues that are troubling our society or challenging our society. And today, Rabbi Shimshon Cohen Adela is with us to discuss the issue of serving in the army for the ultra-Orthodox.
Shalom Yishai. Tensions are high right now in the state of Israel, as the current law exempting yeshiva students from mandatory service in the Israel Defense Forces expired at the end of June, with the ultra-Orthodox parties threatening to leave the current coalition and dissolve the government if a new law granting exemptions is not immediately passed after the Knesset's summer recess ends on October 15th. Exemptions for yeshiva students has been a sore topic since Israel's Supreme Court declared the Tal law unlawful in February of 2012, undoing the decades-long status quo whereby full-time students were exempt from service in the IDF. Advocates of maintaining the status quo argue that those studying Torah provide a spiritual protection to the state of Israel, and that Jewish law allows for exemptions of yeshiva students. But what does Jewish law really require? The Mishnah in the 8th chapter of Tractate Sota states, in a Melchemet Mitzvah, a mandatory war, all go out to battle, even a groom from his room and a bride from her wedding canopy. Drawing on language from the book of Yoel by mentioning bride and groom, the Mishnah expresses a certain urgency and the necessity for everyone's involvement. And while many explain that women are exempt from combat, they are nevertheless obligated to assist in the war effort. In the 5th chapter of his Laws of Kings, the Rambam defines a milchemet mitzvah, a mandatory war, as, quote, a war against the seven nations of Canaan, a war against Amalek, and assisting Israel from the hand of the enemy who comes up against them. With enemy states on our borders and the constant threat of terrorism within, we find ourselves today embroiled in a Melchemet Mitzvah, a national security situation which demands everyone's participation. This past week alone, 3 Israeli citizens were brutally murdered in cold blood. Those who seek exemption from serving in the IDF argue that Toratan Omanutan, Torah, study, is their sole occupation. They point to the end of the laws of Shemitah and Yovel, where the Rambam himself writes that the tribe of Levi is exempt from going to war, as they are the army of God, so to speak. As the spiritual leaders of the Jewish people, they do not inherit a portion in the land, and their material needs are provided for by the rest of the Jewish people. The Rambam continues and writes that any individual, quote, whose spirit moves him, can devote himself solely to Torah study, just like the tribe of Levi, divorced of all material concerns and worries and free from the burden of army service. Quote, such an individual is consecrated as the Holy of Holies. But this passage is very difficult to understand. Commentaries on the Rambam struggle to find a Talmudic source for this ruling. Some point to a passage in Tractate Nidarim where our own patriarch Avraham is criticized for drafting Torah scholars in the war of the 4 kings against the 5, or a passage in Tractate Sota which relates how King Asa was punished for mobilizing Torah scholars. Also difficult, the Rambam himself rules that even a bride and groom must assist in the war effort, as we've mentioned. And by suggesting that Torah scholars can look to their brethren for financial support, the Rambam appears to contradict what he writes in his commentary to the Mishnah in Tractate Avot and to his Laws of Torah Study, where in the 3rd chapter he decries those who rely upon others for their livelihood. Analyzing this passage, Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein of blessed memory, who for many years was at the helm of Yeshivat Haaretz Zion, questioned how many people would fit into the Rambam's criteria and asked in an article, The Ideology of Hesder, which was published in the Torah journal Tradition in the fall of 1981, he asked, quote, Who can confront a mirror and tell himself that he ought not to go into the army because he is Kodesh Kodashim, Sanctum Sanctorum, Holy of Holies, in the Rambam's terms? It would appear that the Rambam's ruling in the laws of Shemitah and Yovel is not the rule, but the exception to the rule. His allowance is reserved for those select few individuals who are able to devote themselves solely and wholly to the service of God. Exempting entire segments of the population from army service and from pursuing a parnasai livelihood is certainly not what the Rambam intended. Additionally, the mitzvot of saving Jewish life, pikuach nefesh, and not standing by the blood of one's fellow, lo ta'amod al dam re'echa, obligate one to save life and protect life. The Rambam, in his Laws of Shabbat, writes, quote, "It is mandatory for every Jew who is able to come and assist his brethren under siege and save them from the hand of the enemy on Shabbat." Here, the Rambam does not allow for any exceptions or exemptions. And while some authorities, like Rabbi Isaac Herzog, Rabbi Tzvi Pesach Frank, Rabbi Yaakov Moshe Charlap, and Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, allowed for the exemption of yeshiva students in the very early days of statehood, in an essay published in 1948, Rabbi Shlomo Yosef Zevin challenged them and asked, quote, "From what source do you derive that Torah scholars are exempt from participating in a milchemet mitzvah, assisting Israel from the hand of the enemy who comes up against them, who threaten to destroy them, heaven forbid?" Rabbi Zevin continues and argues that when Jewish life is at stake, no one may sit idly by. To understand those who ruled against drafting yeshiva students, one must appreciate the state of religious life in the young country, this nascent nation, following the Holocaust, when so much Torah had been destroyed and decimated. Those studying Torah full-time were charged with the task of rebuilding Torah here in the state of Israel. When Rabbi Avraham Yeshaya Karlitz, the revered Chazon Ish, together with other leading rabbis, reached a compromise with David Ben-Gurion to provide exemptions for yeshiva students, only some 400 students were exempted from army service. Writing about a milchemet mitzvah, a mandatory war, the Chazon Ish himself recognized that, quote, "If there is a need for them, they must come to the aid of their brethren." In recent years and decades, those 400 exemptions have grown exponentially. Moshe's rebuke of the tribes of Reuven and Gad, "Shall your brothers go out to battle while you sit here?" resonates with those who see the imbalance in the current situation. And for those concerned about their spiritual life while serving in the army, Hezder and Nachal Haredi units have proven that a healthy balance between Torah study and army service can indeed be achieved. As the Midrash states, the sword and the sefer, the book, are bound up together. True, while not every student may be needed in combat, the current security situation in the state of Israel requires that everyone contribute some form of service to the country. Instead of seeing army service as a burden or a compromise, one should see it for the tremendous mitzvah that it really is. Wishing all of the listeners blessings from Jerusalem.
Good stuff, Rabbi Shimshon Nadel, and he promised me that this would raise some eyebrows, this segment, so I'm excited to hear what you guys think about it. Write me an email, yishai@yishaifleischer.com. That was good Torah, definitely, Amalka. Speaking of Torah, im ein kemach ein Torah, if there is no flour, there is no Torah. Flour means to say like money, and if you want to transfer money into the land of Israel, there's no better way to do it than a dark currencies. And the company called Change 86, I highly recommend them. I use them myself. YossiChange86@gmail.com. Just write to Yossi, Y-O-S-S-I, change86@gmail.com. Malka Fleischer, summer's coming to an end. A little bit more time to see the land, to vacation a little bit. And Rosh Hashanah is coming. I didn't mention it last week's show. It's Elul time. It's the month before. Oh, all my friends at the International Torah Congregation, all of my nation's friends, you have to know that it is Elul. It is the preparatory month for Rosh Hashanah. We are now in preparation. We are talking tshuva and repentance.
Tshuva repentance.
Right? That's right. We're talking about getting just a little bit better, a little bit closer. God is in the field.
That's right. That means he's with us. He's not in the palace.
Right.
Up all high on his big fancy chair. But he's walking through, and that means you can get closer, and you can ask for what you need, and you can talk to him. You can get counsel. You can just see his face and feel the closeness of the great king.
So that's the word for today. We're gonna learn a Hebrew word. Now, everybody say this, even if you know it. Hamelech Basadeh.
Well, it's not a word.
Two words. Hamelech Basadeh. The king is in the field. Hamelech Basadeh. Hamelech Basadeh. Okay.
Yes, good enough.
Yeah, that's right. Hamelech Basadeh. Hamelech Basadeh. The king is in the field. And we sing. Hamelech Basadeh. Hamelech Basadeh. Hamelech Basadeh. Basadeh. Speaking of music, our own roving reporter, Ben Bresky, was in the Sultan's Pool, which is a very unique spot in Jerusalem, a kind of pool area, kind of valley right next to the old city of Jerusalem, right next to the old city walls. And he explored it a little bit. And he tells
us
also,
it's a place with lots of like awesome concerts.
That's right. Speaking of concerts,
festivals,
do you know
stuff.
Who's coming there like August 31st? Shlomo Artzi. Do you remember that you and I saw Shlomo Artzi at Sultan's Pool?
I saw this such a cool concert that's going on, like a Slichot concert.
Yeah.
With all these like cool Israeli artists.
Who's there?
So I didn't. Moshe Ben-Ari, Shlomo Artzi, Ehud Banai.
What?
I know. Slichot.
All right, so without any further ado, here is Ben Bresky with Brechat Sultan, the Sultan's Pool.
This is a moment in Jewish history. Last week, I attended the Hutzot HaYotzer Festival in Jerusalem, an arts and crafts fair with vendors from Israel and around the world, with music, food, and more. As I wandered past the stalls, I saw jewelry, clothing, and art from Peru, Uzbekistan, Bolivia, Hungary, Ecuador, South Korea, and more. There was a variety of Israeli locally produced handcrafted items on sale. A musical act called Cafe Tav performed a mix of cabaret and ethnic music with dancers who encouraged audience participation, jugglers, and acrobats. Different food from Israeli restaurants served falafel and hummus, as well as a variety of food from different cultures. This part of the event was held in the area called Hutzot HaYotzer, while next to it, in the Sultan's Pool, a large concert stage had big-name Israeli acts performing. These two areas are located right across the streets from the old city of Jerusalem. The area of buildings called Hutzot HaYotzer house an artist colony year-round, where artists create and sell their works in a strip of buildings that date back to the 1930s. The neighborhood was once called Jirat al-Anab and was founded by a few dozen poor Jewish families, approximately in 1892. The residents were mostly Moroccan and North African Jews who lived in the then overcrowded Old City of Jerusalem. They purchased the land from an Arab cattle dealer. Among the founders were the families Elbaz, Nachmias, Turgeman, Cohen, and more. The neighborhood at its peak consisted of about 50 buildings, one of which housed a synagogue and Talmud Torah school. The Nobel Prize-winning Israeli author S.Y. Agnon described the neighborhood in his famous book Tumul Shoshom. He looked up and realized he was standing by the Jirat al-Anab neighborhood of Jerusalem. This poor neighborhood is extremely crowded. Each one of its 47 apartment buildings is living quarters for approximately 20 people. Some of them are porters, some leather workers, some cobblers, and some peddlers. Agnon's novel describes Jerusalem from the years 1908 to 1911. There were two flour mills in the neighborhood, one belonging to the Berman family, owners of Berman's Bakery. Begun in the Old City, Berman's is arguably the oldest in the country and today the second largest bakery in Israel. An old millstone used to grind flour is still on display there. The population of the neighborhood, for the most part, was considered to have a low socioeconomic status. The Jewish neighborhood was targeted and residents harassed in such incidents as the Nebi Musa riots of 1920, the massacre of 1929, and the revolt of 1936. During this period, many Jewish families abandoned the neighborhood for security reasons, and Arab families began to move in. The 1939 census indicated only a few Jewish families left. The War of Independence and the invasion of Jerusalem by the Jordanians began in 1948, and the neighborhood was abandoned. The municipal line, which divided East Jerusalem and West Jerusalem, passed through, with the Old City being part of Jordan, and the Old Jurat al-Anab neighborhood becoming part of the buffer zone in between the two countries. The houses of the neighborhood remained abandoned and partially destroyed, and from time to time, children from the neighborhood of Mamila would venture in. In 1967, the Six-Day War unified the city, and great effort was made in rehabilitation. The shops were restored under the direction of Jerusalem's longtime mayor, Teddy Kollek, who sought to bring in artists, and the first Hutzot HaYotzer Festival began in 1969. In the 1990s, the fair began to invite artists from abroad and featured an international pavilion, and by the 2000s, big-name Israeli singers were added to perform at the Sultan's Pool. Today, the Sultan's Pool features a stage and seating for large outdoor concerts. This ancient water basin was used as a supply network for Jerusalem from the late Second Temple period to the late Ottoman period. It was established by building a dam across the Ben Hinnom Valley, which stopped the drainage of the ravine south toward the Kidron Stream and created a water reservoir. An aqueduct carried water from Solomon's Pools near Bethlehem to Jerusalem and the Temple Mount. A covered and plastered hewn channel from the Roman period was discovered along the entire length of the pool, believed to be from the time of King Herod the Great. The pool itself is built on earlier pools, and some researchers identify it with the snake pool, mentioned by the historian Josephus. In the Crusader period, the pool was called Lacus Germani. Sultan Suleiman the Magnificent renovated and enlarged the pool in the 18th century, and some of what he added can still be seen today. Between 1948 and 1967, this too was part of the no man's land between Israel and Jordan. A far cry from the thousands of cheering fans who enjoyed Hebrew rock, rap, ethnic and traditional music as people from all over enjoyed music, food, and art. There are many other historic neighborhoods that have undergone ups and downs, but that is a podcast for another time. This has been A Moment in Jewish History. Thank you to Yishai Fleischer. Thank you to all the listeners and subscribers. And shalom.
All right. Thank you very much, Ben. That was awesome. Very interesting. I love that place. The Brichat HaSultan, the Sultan's Pool. Great place in Yerushalayim, Jerusalem.
Speaking of, I want you to consider supporting the Jewish communities of Israel, especially Hebron, where I have the honor of working. And a good friend of mine, Matthew, recently gave a great donation to the Jewish community of Hebron to strengthen us. And I want to honor that. And I want to thank all the folks that understand the importance of keeping this place strong. This is our fort. This is our Alamo. This is the root of Jewish peoplehood. And the haters of Israel want to uproot it. And the worst is the people who are ignorant of the forefathers and mothers and the Jewish past, of the first city of the Jewish kingdom in the land of Israel. And so Hebron, that's hebronfund.org. And come on our tours, hebronfund.org/tours. And, of course, if you want to touch not the forefathers and mothers, which is in Hebron, but if you want to touch the root of the formation of this world, God's holy abode, where he hangs out, Yoshev Tzion, he sits in Zion. If you want to touch that holy place, you come up to the Temple Mount with High on the Har, highonthehar.com. Check them out. They will take you to the holiest place on earth in holiness. Michael Fleischer, you got to go pick up one of our kids. And so therefore, I want to let you go. And I want to give you a great blessing to have a good trip there and back safely. And in general, continue to do your holy work in this world. And may all of us take inspiration from you to prepare for a Rosh Hashanah properly and have a Shana Tova Umetuka and have a great Elul.
Yes, amen. Thank you.
Give everybody a blessing, Malka. Come on.
Wow, okay. I want to give everyone a blessing first for safety and health. If you got safety and health, you're already like 85% in good situation.
Right.
So I want to give everyone a bracha for safety and health. And I want to bless all of us who are looking for, sometimes you get down, you know? And I find that especially in these times, in the month of Elul, when you get down, that's actually not the worst. Because this time is such an auspicious time for prayer that sometimes I think that Hashem gives some people an extra hard time right now so that your prayer will become like super awesome, so that your desire to connect to Hashem, your understanding of where good times come from, where bad times come from, what a good time is, what a bad time even are, is, what those things are, your understanding is deeper. And so when you pray, when you try to break, you know, your fears or your negativities or whatever, then you have like extra supercharged success.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want to say that for anyone out there who's like facing a hard time right now, hang in there. This is a time of miracles, and it's a time where we crown the king. This is voting time. I like to say every year I vote every year in the elections, and I vote for God every time. And make sure that that's what you're doing too. And vote for yourself also, you know, vote for yourself and understand that you're on Hashem's ticket.
Very good.
And that he wants to take you with him into the next administration. And with God's help, we'll all have good positions in the administration and with excellent benefits and a company car.
Amen. Amen. Okay, Malka, and don't forget to pick up that other kid that's coming with our child home.
Yes.
Don't forget
Thank
him.
You,
okay,
yes. Thank you, yes. I remember that. Thanks a lot.
Okay, Malka, Shabbat Shalom. Shabbat Shalom. Thank you so much. And speaking of Shabbat, we have now a segment that I did yesterday with Rav Mike Foyer in preparation of this very special Torah portion of Ki Teitzeh, which is one of my favorite Torah portions in the book of Deuteronomy for sure. Ki Teitzeh L'Milchama, when you go out to war with a lot of amazing laws. And here is my discussion with Rav Mike here on the Yishai Fleischer Show on the Land of Israel, and on the Land of Israel Network, and on the Yishai Fleischer network of stuff found at YishaiFleischer.com.
All right, everybody, shalom, and welcome to the Yishai Fleischer Show. We are broadcasting live right now. I am in Hebron, and I'm joined by Rav Mike Foyer. Shalom, Rav Mike. How are you?
Shalom, Yishai. It's good to see you.
It's good to see you, and I'm really glad you're joining me today. It hasn't been an easy week. This week already went to a funeral of a murdered lady, a kindergarten teacher from in the town that I live in, Gush Etzion, and also a resident of South Hebron Hills. Her name was Batsheva, and she was in a lift. She got picked up by a friend who happens to be a buddy of mine, who lives in Beit Chagai, and their car was shot up by jihadist terrorists who have recently been caught also. But we went to her funeral. I went to her. I didn't go to the funeral. I went to the flag standing at attention as the ambulance carrying her body to her, you know, final resting place. I don't know, Rav Mike, you know, I know that you have another hat. One hat you have is your history shows, but the other hat that you have is also spiritual counseling. Like, you know, for those of us who, you know, feel the pain, and I also dealt with folks in the diaspora, and I found that some just really didn't want to so much. They said the right things, the conciliatory things, but it's like, it's almost like you want to look away after a while. So I just wanted to ask you, like, first, like, let's just, you know, what would you counsel somebody coming to you for, you know, how to deal with this kind of trauma? Included in that is not that there's just bad guys who want to kill. There's also a government who cannot manifestly defeat the bad guys. And then there's also the Twitter sphere and the social media sphere where when Malka and I write things like, there was, you know, a horrific murder, there is hundreds of responses saying, basically, you deserved it since you're land thieves, et cetera, and the occupation narrative. So how would you counsel us to deal with this, you know, both the destruction of life, the weakness of the government, and the global support for jihadism against us?
Wow, that's not a small set of questions. Let's start with the most visceral first, is that a trauma like this type of murder, whether it's personal, God forbid, for the family and friends, whether it's sort of felt like as part of the national story, or meaning for those of us here in communities, or whether like you're identifying with the diaspora where it seems a little distant, but it's still a pressing issue. The first step in dealing with it is giving space to the natural emotions that arise, whether it's anger, whether it's fear, whether it's sadness, and not trying to rationalize or justify or fit this experience too quickly into a narrative, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that's part of the problem, and that may be part of the sort of almost arm's length response you feel like you get from the diaspora in particular, is that unfortunately this is a story we all know, and it becomes much more manageable when we fit it into the ongoing story. Right, the continuing sacrifice, the cost of the occupation for the left, the, you know, the sacrifices we make for reclaiming our land for the right, etc. And those narratives are important, but if you don't give space to the pain and to the fear and the anger and the sadness, then you risk, first of all, dishonoring those who've been lost, because fitting them too quickly into a story is, to a certain degree, denying their very special, unique humanity. But also, I think what it does is it prevents us from taking the next step relating to your other questions, which is genuinely facing the problem. Right? Because we're used to a story which has no solution. Right? It's just, you know, like I said, from the left, it's just the price we pay for our intransigence and in the occupation. For the right, it's the cost of, you know, settling the land. Now, rightly or wrongly, neither of those actually is a productive approach to the problem of allowing violent, oppositional, jihadist culture, not just to survive, but really thrive in our land. And so that goes to the next question, is that how do we relate to a government, which I don't know if we're incapable. I don't know, because I'm not a security expert. I'm not a political expert, you know, like yourself. But one thing is fairly clear to me, is that there aren't so many interests in winning right now, right? Meaning there seems to be a lot of interest, especially over the last, since Oslo, basically, in a holding pattern. Less so, obviously, in the leadership of Yudan Shomron, because there's still a sense that there's an active attempt to sort of reclaim our heartland. But even there, I think that there's a terrible blind spot, which is that what we're after is sovereignty. And you will never have sovereignty until you relate to the reality of however many, you know, Arab citizens or non-Arab residents, let's say, there are there. Meaning, you can relate to that reality in any number of ways. You can take a path of one state citizenship. You could speak about, you know, resident alien. You could do, I'm not getting into the solution, but sovereignty means power plus responsibility. So on the left, they don't want power, and they're willing to give it up in order to avoid responsibility. On the right, there's too much of an urge to power without taking responsibility, and that ties our hands. You know, you take something like Hawara, where this murder, like two murders ago, I hate to say such a thing, but like within the space of a week, like you pointed out. Why is Hawara Junction actually still functioning outside of the realm of Israeli sovereignty right now, with the number of murders that have happened there? And I can say, why is Hawara Junction still standing and be burnt to the ground in that sort of revenge desire, which I do understand. But that revenge desire is also an avoidance of sovereignty. It's destroy instead of rule. Right? But the vision of Hawara needs to be a place where everybody, Jews, citizens, soldiers, civilians, Arabs, can like do their shopping and get your car washed in peace. You know, again, if that's a real aspiration, then we need to speak about tactics, but I question whether it's an aspiration. And that's the last piece I'll offer, is that it's without clear vision and a vision that can be crystallized in specific actionable goals, we will keep repeating the stories
right.
that we already know. This is what I can tell you from my counseling. This is what people do. If you don't have a clear vision and goals that are oriented toward realizing that vision, you will repeat the stories that you are already living over and over again as much as you think you want to change. That's my short answer.
It's hard to transition between a place of lack of vision and to come to a place of a vision, especially dealing with very hard things. And the other side has a very clear vision, and they articulate it very strongly that we are foreigners, that we are occupiers, that Israel's not meant to be here, that the whole thing's a colonialist enterprise. And then you have even good Jews, good pro-Israel Jews like Daniel Gordis and Klein Alevi and Mati Friedman. And these guys are like on a bandwagon right now to try to boycott this particular government, right? And these guys come off as like they are like big Zionists, and yet they basically are calling for something that's not so different from the other boycotters. It's just that they want to limit it in scope a little bit more. And what my argument to them is, what you don't understand is you are empowering the haters of Israel. The haters of Israel are like, look, even great Zionists like Daniel Gordis are saying that this government is racist, et cetera, and therefore the whole enterprise is racist, and Israeli people voted for racism. So these folks that are trying to limit their attack onto this government, they don't see that they're actually causing tremendous damage to the very name of Israel and empowering the very anti-Semites that they seek to stave off.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you say they don't see it. I think that in particular, Daniel Gordis and Yitzhak Levy are two very intelligent, very discerning people. And maybe it's true they don't see it, or maybe that what we're looking at, as we're seeing in the streets with the protest movement, is an identity battle. And the reality is that this is a battle for people really feel for the soul of the state of Israel, for the soul of the Jewish people, and they're willing to sacrifice, and foolishly many things which they hold to be dear. And because I agree with you, there's no distinction being drawn outside of our internal Jewish discourse, which is a classic Jewish problem. We're a people of nuance. We're splitters, not lumpers, meaning we divide. It's because we care about the truth. Let's remember, there's a tikkun and a kilkul. There's a rectified and a corrupt version of this. But because we're a people who care so much about the truth, and the specificity matters. That's why we split hairs over almost everything, right? But the problem is that's completely lost outside of internal Jewish dialogue. And it does us damage, even though it's, in the end of the day, it's true to who we are. So there's a challenge there in how to manage that dynamic.
Basis, splitters, not lumpers. That's a really fun one.
That's a term from taxonomy, if you're not familiar. There are splitters and there are lumpers.
I did not know that.
When you're trying to put in things into like a genus or species, it's that at a certain point, it gets fuzzy. So people lean towards splitting and towards lumping, Is a platypus really a monotreme, or is it just a mammal with some species issues?
Here it is. I put it up on the screen. Jews are splitters, not lumpers. Okay, how's that? Okay, I like that. But speaking of lumping, here's the front cover of yesterday's Yisrael Hayom.
Oh yeah, I saw that.
And it's got like 35 people who've been murdered from the beginning of the secular year. And that's painful stuff.
Yeah, and for me, as a number of people have noted in the media, it really brings to mind how bad things were when I made Aliyah in 2001. It was in the midst of the Oslo War, so-called Second Intifada. And that was the last time we reached this number. But there, at least, we knew we were at war. And this, by the way, is part of the answer to your question that I didn't get to, which is that we need to accept the reality that we're at war. We've built suburbia on a battlefield, and we're now complaining when mortars land in our playgrounds. Now, again, I'm not justifying the mortars. You follow? But part of the problem lies with us, is you cannot build suburbia in a battlefield and then wonder why people are attacking your children. You need to fight like it's war. I mean, and by the way, ki teitzei v'milchama oivicha, right? Like, it's actually not the ki teitzei of our parsha this week. It's ki teitzei that comes in last week. But you know what Rashi says when you go out to battle against your enemies? Rashi says, well, that's redundant. You don't go out to battle against your friends. You know, Rashi brings the Midrash. What's it say? Why does it say against your enemies?
You got to know to recognize your enemies.
Not just that. You have to remember that they are your enemies, and they will treat you cruelly. They are not your brothers. So when you go out to war, you need to fight to win. And this is our problem, is that for many reasons, lack of vision, fear of the grandeur of what victory might mean, fear of the challenge of what it means to be a Jew, for goodness sake, these things are preventing us from fighting for victory. And that's immoral, I think, on all fronts. You know, and nobody suffers for that more. I hate to put it because I'm not into relative suffering, but nobody suffers for that more than the Arabs. Our inability to fight toward victory, they actually suffer primarily. You know, and which is odd because if you start talking about victory, everything's your right-wing nut that wants to kill Arabs, which is not my point at all. No, I want to bring actually order, a higher order and a better life for everyone involved. But in order to have true sovereignty, then we need to think about what victory looks like and then pursue it.
So let's talk a little bit about Jewish style victory. And one of the things that our Torah talks about in this week's Torah portion, there's a few different discussions about war already leading from last week's Torah portion. First, we learned that you're not supposed to cut down a fruit tree when you're besieging a city, and that you have to make a distinction between the fruit tree is not like a man that you have to kind of kill. You have to respect the fact that there's this thing past the war that you have right now. There's the fruit tree that's going to give fruit past the conflict that you have right now. So be careful about that. Similarly, in this week's Torah portion, it tells us that you're not supposed to take the mother bird along with the eggs when you're trying to take the eggs or the chicks of a bird. And my mother explained to me that I liked her explanation so much is that it's for the sake of renewable energy.
Sustainable resource. Yeah.
Right. Sustainable resource. That's right. So it's like the mother has a chance to continue to be procreative in this world. Okay, take the eggs, but don't wipe out a whole system of creativity in this world. So I think those two are very similar. Don't cut down the fruit tree. Don't take the mother bird together. And yet there's another thing, which is you're going out to war. War is a sweaty, smelly, dirty thing. A army camp is just that. Even the most orderly has an element of, you know, there's not a feminine touch in it. And it's a thing. It's a machine of violence. It's really an organized violence. And yet, the Torah tells us when you camp against your enemies, you shall be aware of everything evil in your camp, meaning to say keep your camp clean. For example, if there is amongst you a man who is unclean because of an external emission, he shall go outside the camp. He shall not come within the camp. And then it shall be towards evening, he shall bathe in water, and when the sun sets, he may come into the camp. It's like, wait a minute, he touched an unclean thing or a body? Like, big deal. Like, that's exactly what you guys are there to do. No, you got to be careful with that. So don't touch a dead body. And here's one that may surprise people. A relative of a dead body, a related concept, is our going to the bathroom. In the sense that these are unclean things. And they're the opposite of life in the sense that it's the excrement of life. It's the end of it. Ostensibly, and the Torah tells us it keeps going. It says, "And you shall have a designated place outside the camp that you could go out to the bathroom there, or use as a privy." The translation says, but basically, use it as a toilet. And you shall keep a stake, meaning to say a little digging tool,
trowel,
in addition to your weapons. So you have your weapons, you have your M16, but you got to have a trowel.
And well, it shall be with an M16 is a waste of effort.
A what? Yeah, digging with an M16, not good. That's right. When you sit down outside, this is the Torah gets quite specific. To relieve yourself, you shall dig with it, and then you shall cover up your excrement. Okay, so it's like, and it's like such a, you know, it's like this is so didactic. And yet when I was in the army, I always made sure to have with me a trowel, to give people a trowel, and then I would tell them, you know, it's a mitzvah. And then the Torah does not spare words, and it says, for the Lord your God goes along in the midst of your camp, to rescue you and to deliver your enemies before you. Therefore, your camp shall be holy. Right? Very famous. Vayamachanecha kadosh. So that he should not see anything unseemly amongst you, and he would turn away from you, and therefore not battle alongside you. And so the Torah tells us, like, if you're going to make war, make it a holy war. Invoke me. Bring me into your camp. Make sure that your camp is clean and also doesn't have, you know, licentious things and posters and things that are not fitting. And so it's important to actually keep your camp holy if you're going to go into this kind of battle.
Well, what's interesting is I knew what you meant when you used that phrase, keep it a holy war. But it's actually a very important distinction between the way the Torah approaches war and the way certain other traditions have sanctified war, is that war isn't holy. Your camp has to be holy.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning, as you point out, war is not holy. It's a dirty, bloody, messy business. Even when it's a mitzvah, right? There is milchamet mitzvah, right? A commanded war, whether it's a defense of the people, whether it's the conquest of the land. But war itself is not where the holiness resides. And it's very clear. Haya machanecha kodesh. Right? Let your camp be holy. Meaning what? You need to keep the bestiality, which is an important tool of war. Because if you're all up in your higher consciousness during war, you're quite vulnerable to all the frailties and complexities that war invites. So you need to center into a deeper fight or flight element of the human being. That belongs on the battlefield, not in the camp. Because if you bring that beast home, then that's what you become. Mm-hmm. And that's, I believe, why the Torah is so specific that you know, the two examples, someone who has a nocturnal mission and someone who needs to, you know, defecate, right? These are two very natural things. But they,
right. There's actually, and there's a third one, right? There's the nocturnal emission.
And the dead body.
Right.
Right. And what the Torah is saying is that, listen, life is life. We don't kid ourselves. The Torah is very earthy in that sense. It knows very well human experience. But when you build the communal structures within which holiness or the opposite, God forbid, could reside, that's where the demand is at its highest. Right? I mean, war may not, we don't have holy war. We have a holy camp, and we go to war because it's a commandment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, that was a good distinction. By the way, when you do speak to folks in the Muslim tradition, and you mention jihadism, which I use oftentimes as a way to describe to distinguish between Arabs or Muslims and the people we're at war with, but in any case, they often say to me that the word jihad means an internal struggle. I always say to them, "Hey, I understand that. That's not a hard concept for me to understand." But the only reason I'm mentioning that is because in this very same Torah portion, there's a very interesting phrase which I think that the Gentile world and the world in general, the globe, should all take this phrase seriously.
Which is?
And that is, observe and do what is emitted from your lips. Motzas fatecha tishmo. Like, watch your mouth. Watch your mouth. And then it continues. And it, as you have pledged or sworn to the Lord, your God, as a donation, keep, which you have spoken with your mouth. You said you made a promise to God. He keeps that. He checks that. It's important to him. Your mouth is a creative thing. It means something to say something. Say the wrong phrase, it could destroy relationships. Say the right phrase, it could build relationships. Talk to God. God's hearing what's coming out of your mouth. And I only mean to say that there's another way that you could see this parsha is that there's a lot of stuff about words. There's a lot about stuff about how words are used. And the very kind of important phrase, which I think all children should be taught as well, motzas fatecha tishmo, like watch your mouth. Watch your mouth. I'm always telling my kids, like, rehearse for a second what you're about to say, hear it, and then judge if it's a good thing. Only then let it out of the gate. Don't fire off exactly what comes to you.
You know, you the three gates of the tongue.
Go ahead, tell me about that. You got that way.
Is it true? Is it necessary? Is it kind?
Very good.
I mean, the first one should almost never pass your lips.
Right.
Right. But even something's true, it's always very important to ask, you know, why am I about to say this? Because the reality is it might be a true statement, but my motivations might not be so pure or good. And then the third piece is kind. It says it might be true. You might even feel it's necessary. But the reality is that kindness is its own value. And that, not that it's an ultimate value, but it is a crucial one. Those are the three gates of the tongue. And if one asks that question, literally asks those questions themselves before they say something, you will find a fundamental shift in your communication.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to totally use that with my kids. So we're saying, is it true? Is it necessary? Is it kind?
Is it kind?
Very good.
In order of priority.
Speaking of kindness, I want to say hi to Marilyn Poe, who says shalom from North Carolina.
They were State of the Union.
That's right. And then we got Edwin, who says shalom from the Philippines.
I've never been there, but it sounds nice.
Yep. And then shalom from NYC. Nice to see you both, says Penny. All right. And then Stephen says shalom from Boston. And then Scott says, oh, the power of the tongue. Too many mouths in the world, not enough ears.
Oh, well said.
Okay. So there you go. So shalom to everybody. And so fun to be able to broadcast to you. I'm in beautiful Hebron right now. This Torah portion has a lot of laws. This is the most chock-filled. This is what's called Ne'um HaMitzvot, the commandment speech in the book of Deuteronomy, the book of Devarim. It's Moses' long speech.
It's 74 commandments. Wow. Out of the total, 613. That's quite an accomplishment, one parsha.
It is, and they are, according to all the sages, all opinions hold that you could even, since it's well-ordered speech, you could even learn from placements of different laws next to one another.
Yeah.
And I there's just so many interesting things, but let's talk about the last part of the Torah portion, and that is about remembering what Amalek did to you on the way. The verse says, what chapter is this? It's chapter 25, verse 17. You shall remember what Amalek did to you on the way when you went out of Egypt, how he happened upon you on the way and cut off all the stragglers at your rear, meaning to say he attacks the weak ones in the back when you were faint and weary. And he did not fear God, or maybe you did not fear God.
That's a big question. Who is not fearing God there?
So, but there was a, let's put it this way, there was a lack of fear of God. Yeah, one way or the other. I mean, the simple reading is you did not fear God enough, but our sages say that he did not fear God. And that's, I mean, his lack of fear of God, that's obvious. Therefore, it shall be when the Lord your God grants you respite from your enemies around you in the land. So it happens in the land of Israel, which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance to possess, that you shall obliterate the remembrance of Amalek from beneath the heavens. You shall not forget. So, I mean, let's just talk about that for a second. What is this, like, glaring dichotomy, right?
Well, remembering not to forget.
Right, remembering not to forget. And then we have this whole mitzvah commandment to read this section. We read it close to Purim. It's all about, like, don't forget what this guy did to you, and you better work towards forgetting it. So just forget about it.
Let's look carefully at what it says. It says, and first of all, it's critical to notice that when God has given you rest from all your enemies around, ba'aretz, in the land, then this kicks in. So why do I say that? It also connects to your original question, which is that the formula of how we're meant to wipe out the memory of Amalek and we remember to wipe it out is a formula for how we're meant to process traumatic personal historical experience and use it as a source for positive identity. And that can only happen to its fullness when we've come to rest, when we're no longer feeling pursued by that which we fear, but we've actually conquered it and put it to rest, and then the trauma can begin to heal, which is why, right, in the land. And I think that that's a big piece of what we're dealing with in your opening question, is that I don't blame our government, I don't blame our society, I don't blame diaspora Jews, I don't blame Israeli Jews for struggling with how to incorporate this new phase of the constant terror, fear, pursuit. You know, the world can call us colonialists and talk about Jewish power all they want, but where we're sitting today is continuity with our struggle to survive that's been going on for more than 2,000 years.
Right.
So, but in this, it gives us hope. Why? Because Zecher, to remember, is literally to remember. It's to take the pieces of the past and to put them back together in the present, because that's where the act actually occurs, in a way in which frees us from the trauma and paves the way for the future that we want. Right? If we're constantly running from Amalek, we think they're always behind us. People act in a very specific way in the present, and in many ways it shapes their future. Whether it's victimhood, whether it's a fearful sense of pursued paranoia. Whereas, if we can reattach, we say, no, we've wiped out that Amalek thing. They're not pursuing us anymore. There's a level of freedom that we gain for the action that lies before us,
right,
which is liberating on levels that we have not yet really begun to conceive, much less achieve.
I guess what's frustrating is that we've come so far, and yet we still have so much more to go. And that's what's frustrating. It's like you have a Jewish state. Not only that, I actually think that we're stronger than ever before economically, and also vis-a-vis our enemies who are weaker than before. When I was a kid, Syria, Egypt, these were serious things.
They were major states, powerful states.
Right, with the backer of a major superpower, the Soviet Union.
I mean, all that has changed.
Right. All this, there is no, you know, Soviet Union that's arming Sam, putting SAMs into the Sinai and all that. And, you know, and it's, we're really the powerful force around here. And yet, you know, and yet we have such a, there, we've allowed these no-go zones and this jihadism to flourish in our land and this contra narrative. And
well, that's the piece that you've taught and you're trying to teach people more and more, is that this shift toward the narrative war came together with the shift away from any sense that classic military power would defeat us.
Right.
And that's why the problems that we face today are problems of perception. They're problems of motivation and vision, because these are narrative issues. It's not an accident that change happened. But yes, you listen, I ever given you my canoe metaphor for Jewish history?
Like the difference between a Jew and a canoe? Is that the one?
No, I hope you're not talking about the Monty Python joke. We can talk about that off the air if you're familiar with what I'm referring to.
I don't know about that one, but
that's about American beer in a canoe. But anyway, maybe in Yavin. But what I'm speaking about is this: is that you've ever been in a canoe?
Sure,
it's a remarkably stable boat, right? You're in the water; it's quite fine.
Yeah,
and when you're on the dock or on the land looking at the canoe, you're in solid ground, right? So think of the canoe as exile. Like when we were out there in, I don't know, 14th century Rhineland or you know, 15th century Tunisia or wherever, we were just out there in canoe. It was like, yeah, Kadosh Baruch Hu is going to bring us home. We know. We have faith. It's a stable situation, even though we're adrift, so to speak. We, you know, and obviously when we're in our land, we're 2 feet solidly on the ground. But you know what the real moment of danger is, if you've ever actually been in a canoe, is when you're trying to get out.
Right.
And you got 1 foot in the boat and 1 foot on the land. And now suddenly, every puff of wind, every ripple on the water, every pebble on the shore, it's like, everything feels so, except you've made such progress. You're halfway out, right? But the danger and the fear and the instability is what we're experiencing now. And we can't lose sight of that.
That's a great metaphor. And maybe that's when Amalek attacks, right? When you're a little bit tired, when you're on the way home, and when you have a few people straggling, you're almost there.
And when you lack Yirat Shamayim, meaning the other challenge is that we've taken a stance of agency, which I'm an advocate for. We decided to get out of the boat. We didn't wait for, you know, the magical tractor beam to raid down and lift us out and set us safely ashore. We took the action. good, bad, or otherwise, it's a done deal. We're in it, you know? But the challenge there is that it's very hard to have a true sense of awe of the divine, that God is really the agent in creation, while nevertheless still maintaining that absolutely essential posture that we are significant actors. That's why this parsha has 74 votes.
That's right.
There's no more important indicator that your actions matter.
Right. And that God gives you blessings. He brings you back home, but you still have to fight. You have to fight against the bad guys. You just got to do it. That's part of it.
Creation is a partnership. It's what it's meant to be.
I mean, we're not going to get into this now, but the longer conversation is that the enemies have also created all kinds of narratives in order to weaken you. They have actually figured out how to weaken response, how to cut you off at the pass, if it were, as it were. And they're good at that. They're good at limiting that toxic masculinity that it takes to defeat, you know, an Amalek.
Oh, yes.
They're good at that. All right, but Hashem has given us a guidebook and a lot of important laws that keep us both pure, keep our even our army pure, in our relationship with nature, in proper, like, for example, going to the bathroom is good, and we even say a blessing afterwards. But that does not mean that you should bow down to your poop or poop in front of an idol. That you should not do, and that's an imbalance between those things. And so thank God for the Torah. Rav Mike Foer, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I think people can join you at your other websites, jewishstory.co
and ravmike.com.
There you go.
And stay tuned for the Jewish Heroism Project coming up.
Very good.
Start pumping out new content after the Chagim, please, God.
Very, very excited. God bless you, folks, wherever you are. Stay tuned, stay connected. We'll be right back with more on the Yishai Fleischer Show. Thanks, Rav Mike. All right, folks, we are back here on the Yishai Fleischer Show. And I'm on my own now for just a few minutes. I want to thank everybody for joining us. And it's been a great time. And speaking of time, I want to mention good friends and also great supporters of our show, which is RetroWatchGuy.com. They make available to you amazing watches from the past that are awesome today. That's just like Judaism. It's something from the past that is awesome today, and it's working. Keeps going. It keeps telling time. Keeps telling us how to connect to God in our time as well. So that's RetroWatchGuy.com. It's been a lot of fun to have the show today, and I'm really so proud to have such a great team, including Yocheved Seidman, Moshe Herman, Ben Bresky, Tabitha, and Lewin, when we are live, to be part of our shows. And I want to also remind people that there's great ways to support the show, including buymeacoffee.com/Yishai, buymeacoffee.com/Yishai, or the YishaiFleischer.com page. Check out also our Biblical Highway page there and see what we're doing. Coming up soon is the movie that's coming out made by David Friedman and Mike Pompeo about the Biblical Highway. The Biblical Highway Route 60 is becoming a reality here in the land. I'm very proud to have played a role in that and continuous role in that. So be part of that and support that. I want to thank all the good friends out there that are supporters, friends, listeners, people who comment, people who write me an email. So much appreciated. So much love out there. And I want to thank, of course, the greatest sponsor of our show, which is God Almighty Hashem, who's given us the opportunity to live in this great time, a challenging time, no doubt a challenging time, and oftentimes a painful time. But it is such a blessing and such a gift to be able to be active in this time, to be able to have a role. And I bless you that you find a role to be active one way or another in the narrative war, in the war, you know, for Israel's beautification and its strength and its education and its sports and its holiness and all the things, anything that you could find in your life that you could be just a small part of the story of the rebuilding of Israel. In my opinion, it's one of the greatest gifts that God could give you, is that you identify something that you could be part of his story. And I think that his story right now is the building of Israel. So I am sending you lots of love and lots of blessings for success from the good land, of the land of Israel, the land of Judea, Jerusalem and Hebron and all the great cities, the holy cities of our God. And may Hashem be with us and give us strength through this time and help us come before him this Rosh Hashanah in purity and in humility, and come before him and ask him to bless us to just be part of his great vision. Stay tuned, folks. More great stuff is on the way. Lots of love and shalom.